Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Discover our 2-to-1 offers at your local Kia dealer. For more, log on to kia.com.
And find out what lies beneath your county. And meet the parts of your average mobile phone that are older than your average dinosaur. At Down to Earth at the National Museum of Ireland, Collins Barracks. Admission is free. Visit museum.ie. Brought to you by the Government of Ireland.
RTE supporting the arts.
Supporting artists.
Supporting us.
This Halloween, the RTE Concert Orchestra is inviting you to a spooktacular family concert. Alistair Malloy will guide us through creepy classical and freaky funk, haunted mansions and the hero of Hogwarts, cool ghouls and ghostbusters. It's an hour of great fun, spooky stories and fantastic music, all conducted by Stephen Bell. That's spooktacular. Sunday, October 31st, 2:30 at the National Concert Hall. Tickets from €15. See rte.ie/co.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Discover our 2-to-1 offers at your local Kia dealer. For more, log on to kia.com.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. Joe at RTE.ie. Anne Coughlin, Anne, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Good, thanks. And you contacted us because you want to highlight a group you've become involved with called Physical Impairment Ireland.
Yes.
But in the course of your contact, maybe, I hope I'm not summarising it incorrectly, but you are glad that eventually, after going through years of hell with pain, that you had an amputation.
Yes.
Tell us what happened.
I had an accident in January 2010, walking down my sister's driveway, and it was a very bad winter.
Okay.
I fell on my ankle, absolutely smashed my ankle, and I was brought to Portiuncla, where from there I was transported to UCHG. I had surgery done on the 14th, and it wasn't successful. And over the past, from 2010 until June 2020, I had 16 surgeries.
Wow.
None of them were successful. I'm a person who gets infections from every single surgery that I have. But in the March of 20, I was diagnosed.
What was the pain like for that decade?
Oh, it's actually very hard to describe, Joe. My sister, my best friend, will probably tell you better than me. I never had any other colour except grey. I was in agony. I never missed work, but it was just like it was never going to end. And then I was diagnosed with breast cancer in March 20, and I had a lumpectomy done in May. And I was told then I'd have to have radiation in September. Thank God I didn't have to have chemo. I'm on an oral chemo drug for the next 3.5 years. But in the middle of being told I have breast cancer, my body began to reject the metal from my leg.
Okay.
So I was brought in March. My subtalar joint had snapped. They tried to rectify it, but in all fairness, like, he done everything he can, and you know, he like tried absolutely everything. But then what happened was I got an E. coli infection up the front of my leg, and there was like a screw or a bolt coming out through my heel, and my niece Sarah, she's a nurse, and she said you need to go to the hospital straight away. But lucky I was at clinic that morning. Professor Kern said, we're going to have to operate on you in the morning and remove it. But then the infection started to, like, really go fast up my leg.
Okay.
He got everybody involved in St. Finbar's and UCHG. They all said the same thing. If the E. coli spreads into my body, the radiation won't work.
And when was the option of amputation raised?
2 days before.
And what was your reaction?
I'll be honest with you, it's kind of like you're told that somebody's going to die. I know it sounds a bit kind of, you know, insane, but after having a leg for 54 years, you're kind of going, you know. But then, like, that option and the pain that I was always going to go through in my life, my sister and I, she was absolutely amazing. Claire, she was in the hospital with me the whole time. Gosh. And COVID was very rife at that stage, but she was allowed in. And we decided that, we could go for the amputation. So that was really it. I had the amputation. Of course, I got an infection. So Professor Kearns had organised for APOS to come in to me the night before the surgery to actually measure me for my new prosthetic.
What do they call that? APOS?
APOS in Galway. They're Atlantic Prosthetic Ortho Services.
Okay.
They're absolutely amazing. But the weird thing is, Joe, a lot of people don't know, if you're amputated below the knee, it's like an amazing thing to keep your knee, and you're only going to know that when you've had an amputation.
Right.
You'll be talking to a friend of mine soon that he has had an amputation above the knee, and it's a totally different life. But my main reason for emailing into the show is that, we're in 2020, every day that a disabled person leaves their house, they are facing obstacles all day.
Yeah.
We're fighting for little things like, don't park in a disabled parking space if you don't have a blue badge.
Absolutely.
We have to walk further if you can't park there. Number two, medical cards for people with cancer and people with any kind of disability, doesn't matter what it is. We're just asking for little, you know, and we haven't lived through the experience. We're living through the experience. But my experience is I have had the most amazing journey. And if it wasn't for my family, especially my sister and my best friend Caroline, I wouldn't have got through it. No way.
And in terms of the pain levels after the amputation, Anne.
Oh, my God, there was nothing.
So is that the first time you've been pain-free in over a decade?
Yeah.
Wow.
Basically.
My God.
When I was going down for the surgery, my sister walked me down. Sorry, I'm getting...
Now, take your time. Take your time.
And she was holding my hand all the way through, and then I had to go through the doors, and she never left her seat for 7.5 hours.
Wow.
Outside the theatre door.
Isn't that incredible?
And my surgeon himself went out to her and said, she did great. You know, I think she was still hoping maybe they could maybe see something that might save my leg. But no, there was nothing. So it was very emotional going down. And I was surrounded by this team of people. I can't even explain it. Anyway, I went down and I went into the theatre, came back, woke up. First thing I did was put back the blankets and I said, okay, I can't go back. That's it.
Yeah.
I have two choices, crawl into a corner and die or get on with it.
And how soon afterwards did you get a prosthetic?
I walked for the first time the end of August last year. I had a temporary leg. Now, I would have run out the door with this leg on, but you have to be very careful with somebody who's had an amputation because their limb is completely going to change and they put in so much work. I had the easy part. The work they do is unreal.
Yeah.
Unreal.
And I didn't know until you contacted us, Anne, and pointed out this organisation that you come in praise of it because they've become great colleagues and comrades.
Oh, my God.
Physical Impairment Ireland. I didn't know there's up to 1,000 amputations a year in Ireland.
Yeah, there's one every 5 minutes. No, it's actually higher than that, Joe. No, sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry. It's one every 10 seconds in the world.
In the world, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you named a number of people that you almost want to honour, but you want them to tell their stories and the issues that you're trying to highlight as well as the issues you're trying to raise. Gabe Cronelly is from Athenry.
Yeah.
He's in Belgrade at the moment. He's participating for Ireland at the World Boxing Championships. Gabe, good afternoon. I know there's a bit of delay, so if you could... tell us, Gabe, what are you doing in Serbia?
I'd like if I was participating, but I'm there to support.
Oh, good. Okay.
So we have seven Irish boxers there, and
brilliant.
One amazing young man from our own club, Adam Hessian, so from Monavea Boxing Club, who's out on Thursday, and myself and his dad, Brian, came out here this morning, and we will be shortly going to the Stark Arena in Belgrade.
Okay, well, best wishes.
Watch the boxing.
Best wishes to the lads and the team. Now, you're an amputee, Gabe. I don't know whether that's the proper, because you don't, there's more, obviously more to your life than that. But can you tell us what happened in your case?
2009 in December, I was out hunting, and with a friend of mine, the gun was accidentally went off, and mm-hmm. I got shot into the side of the right knee at close range.
Okay.
And in the space of 8 weeks, I had 13 operations to save my leg, and the 14th one was amputated above the right knee. 13 tried to save it, and the 14th then was the, I suppose, the worst option, but the best that after everything they tried to do to save it.
Anne had 16 operations to try before the leg was amputated. In your case, you had 13 operations.
He's just behind me, Joe. Yeah.
Wow, okay. And that was 13 operations in the space of how long, Gabe?
8 weeks.
Wow.
And I suppose when you're on first name terms with the anaesthetist, things are fairly serious.
So you went under, 14 then for the operation, but you went under 14 general anaesthetics in 8 weeks?
Yeah.
It's incredible.
And they reckon it takes almost a year for any one to get out of your system, so I think I could have spent a few years anaesthetized afterwards.
And when did you realise, Gabe, that the amputation was the only option?
Again, like Anne there now with infection, and I suppose from being bed bound as well, I got a clot in the lung, and that was actually worse than anything. It was unbelievable pain. But again, I suppose like Anne there with my wife and three young kids at the time, and friends and family and the whole lot got us through it.
Now, you're a founding member of Physical Impairment Ireland. Why did you set it up?
Well, amputations are more common than you think, because when the prosthetics are padded out and the whole lot, and people are wearing, between upper and lower limbs, they do look quite lifelike, and never judge a disability by a visual. It's just if you see somebody with a limp, you kind of go, oh, the last thing you think is, well, there's a prosthetic under that.
Mm. Yeah.
And then the person you met when you were in the National Rehabilitation Hospital in Dunleary was Peter Gohery. Peter, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
And can I begin, as I did with Anne and Gabe, tell us what happened in your case, Peter, that brought you into Physical Impairment Ireland?
Well, just a few weeks, probably a month and a half before Gabe's accident, I had my accident. I had a farm accident, and I got wrapped up in a power shaft that amputated my leg, the left leg below the knee, the evening of the accident. Mm. It was all because of my own fault. I didn't have a proper cover on the power shaft, and I had a loose piece of clothing, and I came in close proximity to that power shaft. And it ended up, it just sucked in the loose clothing, and when it sucked it in, it just made a rope effect, and it took the leg clean off me below the knee. So I suppose that evening, my 10-year-old son was with me. He went down, he got my wife to come up. She took care of me, tied off the leg. She wouldn't let me turn over because she was afraid I could have spinal injuries. And I was lucky in the sense that the second ambulance was on in Ballinasloe that week, because it was October Fair week. Now, at the time, the government were trying to bring in cuts to the, I suppose, the hospitals and that, and make them only have one ambulance. And
it was 2009, the collapse,
collapse, yeah. Gosh. So, lucky they were out within 20 minutes, half hour. They got me into Ballinasloe. We then rushed from Ballinasloe then to UHG.
Galway.
Or inside UHG in Galway. they made the decision then that they had to amputate the leg above the knee. As Claire, or as Anne rightly pointed out there, it is harder for an amputee to walk, above knee amputee, you know, compared to a person below the knee. And then if you're an able body, it's the equivalent of walking or me running all day long where you're just walking.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah. The effort, yeah. Yeah. And Peter, Peter, when your incredible son, you're incredible, you were your incredible son having to wear it all. And then what did your wife, you were conscious through all of this, were you?
Yeah, I was conscious through the whole thing. You know, I remember that evening trying to turn over in the ground, you know, like, and put more clothes under me because it stripped the overalls off me. And all I was sitting there was on a white T-shirt. Yeah. And my wife came up. She made sure that I didn't turn over. She made me sure that I stayed still until the ambulance came and they got me in and got me checked out. Lucky she's a nurse and, you know, she knew what to do as
And she was, sounds like she was firm with you.
Oh, she was, yeah. You know, like, and I suppose she held the whole thing together, you know.
And then you met Gabe in the National Rehabilitation Hospital, and then I want to bring in Leo, and then we'll talk about what Physical Impairment Ireland are trying to achieve. Leo Kavanagh. Leo, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
I know you know Gabe and Peter and Anne. Only too well. Contacted us originally.
Larry, Curly and Mo.
Okay, Larry. Leo, how did you become involved in Physical Impairment Ireland?
I became involved with Physical Impairment Ireland because I had met the two guys, the two Galway boys, through an organisation called Embrace Farm. Two lads being countrymen like myself, we just came into contact since then, and ever since then it has all been downhill. Oh, sorry, I mean uphill, Joe, naturally. We've become very close friends, and we decided that it was time for to establish an organisation in Ireland for people with physical disabilities where we would basically manage and run the show for people with physical disabilities in Ireland, because there was nothing else like that, nor is there at the minute currently out there for us. We don't have any... we're not one of the big organisations that would have chief executive officers, etc. And we just felt there was a huge necessity for the organisation.
Yeah.
And you tell us what you do, Anne. You hold talks, obviously. There's Zoom calls, which is the way of the world now. Make Way Day. What's Make Way Day?
Peter,
do you want to tell me about Make
Way Day? DFI brought out Make Way Day there back in September, 23rd of September, I think it was a Friday. So what we did in our organization was we went around, we took pictures of disabled parking spots. We brought around a photographer and we showed them. Now, one of the local, one of our own local towns had a disabled parking spot in it. And right next to the disabled parking spot, they planted a tree. With a barrier around it.
Okay.
Now, for a disabled person to park in that parking spot, they have to open the door full extension in order to get out. But because of where the tree is planted, you can't get out of it. And it's outside a council building. Now, I'm not blaming the council. Look, some people just didn't see that it was a big problem for people with disabilities. Now, if we had to move back the car a little bit more, we end up, we're parked in another bay.
Yeah.
Or if we move it up forward, we're parked in a walkway and it's a danger to other people. Now, what we were saying is on that Make Way Day is also trying to bring it to the minister and to the council for any of the traffic management or any of the local traffic guys that go out, ticket officers. If they go out and see someone parked in these bays, give them the appropriate ticket, which is €150.
Yeah.
It is costing us €45 every 2 years to have this blue badge in order to park there. So we want is the appropriate fee.
But you have the blue badge for a reason.
Absolutely.
We have it for a reason.
You shouldn't have to pay anything.
Exactly. But what we want then is to ring fence this money and to pump it back into designing the proper disabled parking spot. So if you're a person with a wheelchair, you need an extra wide parking bay. Also need it longer so that if you need to get the wheelchair out of the back of the car, that you can.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
Common sense kind of ideas, Joe, is what we were coming up trying to highlight with the Minister for Disabilities and with the local government and with the local guards, not to issue just a traffic offence, issue the appropriate fee, make sure it's ring-fenced then for us to make sure that these are painted. It's costing in the region of €2,000 to paint these traffic bays.
And that they're few and far between, but they are very, very, very valuable for people who with disabilities.
Exactly,
you're right, Joe. They are very bad.
And Anne, in your what was the joy for you in meeting the three lads, Peter, Gabe, and Leo?
Originally when I started going to APOS and I was being refitted for my second leg, the most wonderful Breed of Clancy, she's over APOS in Galway. Gave me a number of a guy called Peter Gohery, who is actually very good friends with my brother-in-law, my sister.
Okay.
And I rang him one day. She said, just give him a ring. And, you know, it's amazing how people out there can help you through this. And anyway, eventually I rang him because I was feeling a bit kind of, even though I'm surrounded by people, you're very much on your own when you've had, like, it is a catastrophic surgery, you know. But I rang him anyway, and I became a part of Embrace Farm. And I used, like, the banter to be going back and forth and all this. And, you know, it was lovely to know that I had people out there kind of on the same level as me. Because we are few and far between, but there are a lot of us.
Yeah,
we just don't know.
But,
Anne, you know?
But Anne, do you think... My aunt, and unfortunately, Rini died just over a year ago, and she had an amputation when she was 16. Her arm got caught in a knitting machine in Dublin. This would be back in the 1960s. And she had a very, very, she's a beautiful, witty woman, true dub, but she had a very basic prosthetic. And Rini, God rest her, used to hide it on us when we go and visit her and her sister Rose and Kevin, her brother. She would put a cardigan or a tea towel or whatever. And I just wonder, are there many people in Ireland who have amputations but for one reason or another don't have the confidence to maybe try and get a better prosthetic or come out publicly or join a group? Do you think there are many hidden amputations, so to speak?
There are a lot of hidden amputations. We have a great story of one guy and his father. And this guy joined the group on behalf of his father because his father is in his late 70s.
Okay.
And this man, I said, now the lads can contradict me here. I'm not sure if I have a right. This man has had the same prosthetic since the 70s. Am I right, Peter?
Yes, the 60s, the 70s, and gentlemen have had this prosthetic, and it's like something that you would see
put on a robot.
It reminds me of something from Downton Abbey, to be honest with you, Joe. The type of prosthetic that people were given after World War II.
Oh, God.
That's how bad it is.
Yeah.
And this gentleman was also informed by the rehabilitation hospital that he attends that they wouldn't be able to give him another one due to, as you get older, as you know yourself, your muscles and everything, start to contract. And that his, Stone explained to me that his leg was about the same width as his arm now at this stage. And that they basically went, no, you won't be getting anything from us, unfortunately.
And Peter, I presume, this is very sad stuff, but I presume today prosthetics, as I think Anne alluded to, are much, much better.
Yes, there is, but they're very expensive.
Are they? Okay.
Yeah, you see, like, you take the leg that I'm wearing, Joe. Now, I got it in America. I was lucky to Breed of Clancy from APOS that referred me to America. And it ended up, it was a Dublin person that I met out there. They owned a company who was actually supplying the American Army with prosthetic legs.
Okay.
He's one of the main guys. And in fairness to him, like, he gave me a leg. But the leg is worth in €40,000.
Wow.
And without it, I don't think it has to be plugged in to be charged, you know, to give the knee better support. and to get going a sea leg. And but the problem with these legs is they can cost anything up to 100,000.
Yeah.
But as a person, you have to go out then, you know, like, work for this to pay for it.
Yeah.
So you take it, it has a lifespan of about three to five years.
Course,
if you're very hard-mid, you can wear it out in 3 years. If you're lucky, it'll last to five. But then where do you do? Start again and... So like
Do you get any state help, Peter, for prosthetics?
No, that's why we were also looking for any person with an amputation should be entitled to a medical card.
Yeah.
Why should you have to be going out to pay for your disability?
Yeah, absolutely.
And like, we can't even get a loan, Joe, to apply for a loan to fund our leg because it isn't recognised as a, I suppose, as an essential thing to buy, you know, and it's probably to us, it becomes your best friend, like literally, you know. And there are a lot of people out there that will never be able to wear a prosthetic, either after the surgery or the way their limb forms when the years go on or whatever. You know, like, we are like a group of the very, very lucky people in the world, I think. I'll be honest with you. And if I had to do it all again, I would.
Mm.
I would pick the same thing all over again. Yeah.
Yeah. Gabe, you stood for election and you won. You ran for the local election. Is that correct?
Yeah, I ran in 2014 and got re-elected again in 2019.
Yay.
And it would be one of only a very handful of people with disabilities in local government. And the representation isn't there with people with disabilities. And if you want to know something about a disability, you ask the person with a disability
because
we are actually problem solvers. And the system is the one that creates the problem because it's created by able-bodied people to tell disabled people how to have a disability. And that's where the problems are.
Yeah.
Again, as Anne said there, you know, when you're, I think it's some of the terminology that's used, you know, like, and the stream of funding that you can only get a prosthetic through as a medical card, I'm not entitled to one because I'm means tested through my work and my wife. And all I'm doing is working to pay for a prosthetic. I broke the prosthetic knee I had recently and ended up having to pay $6,500 for it.
Good God.
No funding whatsoever.
But if you had to, I know we've done the issue before, but for example, say a wheelchair, do people who need wheelchairs have to pay for it themselves?
Some of them do. Again, if you're being means tested for a medical card or any other medical device or anything like that you wear over a certain threshold, you're not entitled to a medical card. And part of the UN Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities is to individualise the disability, that the person with the disability should be given whatever they need to lead an inclusive life and not being punished financially to fund. Nobody wants anything for nothing.
Yeah.
But when you, like, for us to compete in daily life, the effort that we put in is twice that of an able-bodied person.
But I don't think in the world we live in, where I think a lot of us would know amputees, I told my story, that people would begrudge an amputee, the state, helping to make an amputee more mobile.
Yeah.
Well, if you look at employment rates with people with disabilities, it's quite shocking because the financial penalties imposed, that if you're lucky enough to be able to hold down a job, you know, with a disability, the financial, if you earn X amount of money, the disability isn't taken into it. It wouldn't be top of the range prosthetic at 20,000 euros.
And what were you working at when you had the accident, Gabe?
I was working in the construction industry, and like that, I spent 4 years where I wasn't really able to do anything.
Mm.
And that, you know, it's not a good place to be. You want to do something, you want to be, you know, part of society, but you're really cast aside. And, I ran for election in 2014.
Did you lose your job?
I did, yeah. I couldn't work. I was a heavy plant fitter. I can't carry anything much more now than a laptop and a few more things because I'm constantly keeping an eye down to make sure my leg is under me when I'm walking, when I'm doing daily chores that people take for granted. It's about educating, living experience. Yeah. It's not lived experience. It's nothing else, only living.
Yeah.
Because you have to improvise day in, day out to cope with a disability. And, the only ones who can tell you about it are the people who are actually going through it.
Yeah, who are. And Leo, Kaffin, Leo, I'm conscious that, as you say, you were born with a congenital disability, was limb length discrepancy.
I was born with congenital hip deformity back in 1966. At 2 weeks of age, Mum discovered that my left leg was slightly shorter than my right one. I was hospitalised in an orthopaedic hospital shortly after that and spent the next 2 years of my life in that hospital.
And was there any group there that your mother could, like, I presume Physical Impairment Ireland is a relatively recent organisation, but was there any, given that you've had this since you were born, Leo, was there an organisation that you or your family could link in to as you were growing up?
Not really, because I was slightly different in that, unlike the other three guys, I'm a non-amputee, but that doesn't make us any different. Basically, no, there wasn't. And Joe, in those days, and right up until very recently, right, that when you think of it, that there's 13.5% at the last census of the population in 2016 of people with a disability in this country. The vast majority of these people, Joe, don't know who to turn to or where to turn to, especially if you acquire a disability. You're left in a very, very lonely place, Joe. Like, I would actually consider myself very lucky to have been born with this physical impairment or disability. Like, if I had been left in the same boat as Anne and the two guys, I don't know if I'd be around today. Yeah. Seriously, I don't, Joe. Yeah. Okay. I think I would be in a very bad place. And these people are always in good form, the three of them. Especially Peter and myself. I've taken over from his wife, I think, because I speak more to Peter than Peter's wife does at this stage, and I have to listen to Peter more than his wife, so I did Jean a massive favour, I think.
Okay. Take your point.
No, behave.
And your shout out for Physical Impairment Ireland, how do people contact you, and well, we have a very good picture of what you can offer, but how do people become involved?
Well, first of all, we're on Facebook, and I think the Facebook is a very, very good way of communicating with people. Leo is brilliant for setting people up on the page. It just literally takes your name, your email address, and phone number, and they can message it to any of us. Physical Impairment Ireland, you can message in private as well. So,
excuse me, I'm sorry, I do apologize.
You're right.
Our email address, Joe, is Physical Imp Ireland, so that's spelled PHYSICLIMPIRE@gmail.com.
Okay.
Or alternatively, you can contact us on telephone number 087-273-8194, where you will
we'll put all those details up on Twitter and Facebook,
Joe.
and our website as well.
And Joe, can I just add, like, you know, people out there who are maybe afraid to sign up to an organisation like ours, it was literally the best thing I have ever done. And if I'm having a bit of a dip, now, in all fairness, I've had more good than bad days, but thank God. But if I'm having a bit of a dip, I will put a message up on the page. Yeah. How's everyone going today? Or you know, and I always get an answer. It doesn't matter who it's from, you know. But like, don't be afraid to contact, to join, because some people are just afraid to state that they have a disability.
Okay, you're here. Well said.
You know, and we're very proud of who we are right now.
Okay, well, you're a fantastic quartet, and tragically united in through various forms of disability. But it's a magnificent quartet.
I don't know if it's tragic, Joe.
Okay, do you not think so, Peter? No.
No, I suppose the last thing. But I can't.
But Peter, I'm reading through, and I didn't want to go into it in great detail, but. Like the your description of what happened on that day, the shaft running. You heard a knock from inside a machine. You didn't know the shaft, or I didn't know the shaft creates a vacuum. There was no cover on it, and you're sucked in. I think that's. But anyway, I take your overall point, and I'm not. I don't want to contradict you, but I think it's an incredible quartet, the four of you. I think it's a great organisation, Physical Impairment Ireland. And I'm thinking of people who, for various reasons, like that man you spoke about, is in the same prosthetic for 4 or 5 decades, and to help them. Even talk about it, even maybe through their families, as was the case of that man. But anyway, keep up the good work. We put all the details up. Anne Coughlin, Pierre Gorey. Yes, who wants the last word there? Leo?
Yes, we're all here, as Joe said. So if you feel like giving us a call, you're more than welcome to do so.
Okay.
We'll always revert back to you if we can talk to you. That's very
okay, time. Fair play. Leo, did you want to come in there?
Peter, Joe, real quick, is just look at. I've seen it the last few days. We were invited down to a talk, Gabe and myself, down in Limerick.
Okay.
And when you bring people to have a disability and talk about to school kids or to farmers or to the public in general, you know, the knowledge that they get straight away from you, you know, and to see real life instead of reading it in a book or looking at the pictures, but once you're there, shown the lake. You know, like that day below in Limerick was unreal. There was over 150 in it. And I suppose, you know, to the Garda, they'll Curtin Burke for holding a day on mental health and being able to go in and meet people and talk. That's all we're about, is being able to talk, pushing the minister to get something done for people. Small steps, baby steps, but to make those changes and not to make the huge big ones. But we will do them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well said.
And we're not afraid to talk, Joe, as you've just heard from the other three guys as well.
Okay.
No.
And Peter, Gabe, and Leo from Physical Impairment Ireland. And thank you. The initial contact there was made to us from Anne Coughlin and Ballinasloe. Joe at RTE.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
We've done copyright before, but I haven't heard something so blatant as what's happened. Laura Dempsey in Kildare. Laura, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Well, tell us what happened. Your ideas have basically been, your artwork has been stolen. Okay.
Yeah, so I've built my business over the last 2 to 3 years, and most of my traffic kind of comes from Instagram.
Yeah.
So I post my artwork and my ideas and things on that. And also through that, I've met other Irish businesses who kind of become a bit of a community. And Pat from Reusey, she's a great champion of other businesses. So she alerted me to it. She sent me the link to some seller on Amazon who was selling one of my illustrations as their own. And then when I found it, I found that they were selling on other platforms. So they're also selling it on Walmart, and they're selling it on a website based in Kuwait called Ubuy, and it's also on eBay. So I was
How do you know it's yours?
It's because it's my handwriting.
Okay. it's radio. Just explain it to, because it is quite obviously yours. Explain to listeners how unique this is.
I do lots of different illustrations and drawings for cards and prints, and I'm such an overthinker that I can kind of sit on designs for a long time, and I release things when I think that they're right.
Okay.
So this, and when I first started, I used to use typefaces, but I developed my handwriting. I kind of prefer my own handwriting now on things, and kind of makes it more unique and it's become kind of part of the brand. So it's just a lyric from the Elton John song, and it just says how wonderful life is now you're in the world.
Okay.
On quite a simple rainbow background, but it resonates with a lot of people, and it's become one of my better sellers. So
it is quite distinctive. Your handwriting,
it is,
is a kind of bouncy, jolly handwriting. Very, it's very clear. It's very clear. The construction of the words, the layout of the piece, the moon, the star, the rainbow, they're all very unique. Now, that was a print or whatever. Now it's coming up. It's coming up. I see it on a pennant. That people
hang. Yeah, so like a canvas banner. And I think that's the more annoying thing is making, like they've stolen it.
Who's producing them?
Someone in China. I don't know. And I think that's the more annoying thing is of all the designs they could have stolen, they chose one of my simpler ones and they didn't even scale it properly. So it's really frustrating because it's my own handwriting and they didn't even bother doing it properly.
And what else have they done? You see, how wonderful life is now you're in the world, Elton John. Well, it would have been Bernie Taupin, wouldn't it, who probably wrote the lyric. Do you owe them any money?
No. So
because
I've
of the
tried.
Phrase.
Well, I hope not. I don't know.
No, it's a common enough phrase. But you see, I'm looking at the various things that have been hijacked.
Yeah.
And they're now selling your design for babies' nurseries, how wonderful life is now you're in the world, obviously welcoming a new baby, a hanging flag banner, a front door.
And they've taken it down off Amazon, but it's still available on the other website. And I contacted Walmart about it.
Okay.
But they said because it's a third-party seller,
Walmart, the biggest company in America, the biggest supermarket group in the whole wide earthly world, and how do you contact Walmart?
I tried.
We can't even contact Facebook, and they're based here. How do you?
I went on their live chat, and I was speaking to customer service, and she was all like full of apology, and she gave me a 10 euro voucher for Walmart, and I was like, well, I don't really want a 10 euro voucher for Walmart, but if you could just take down my artwork. So I approached it that way with customer service, and then I also filled out an IP infringement form, but it's all jargon, and it's all, but like, I went to art college, I don't really understand all of that stuff, so I'm kind of still waiting to hear from them. But like, I work with brands as well. Like, I do wholesale, and like, they, so whoever is selling it, like, I would very easily do it for them legit. It doesn't have to be stolen.
Yeah.
So like, I would love to work. I'd love to be selling on Walmart if it was legit.
If you get onto Walmart legitimately and they took your product legitimately,
you'd be made.
And is there, because from time to time there's been packaging disputes between supermarkets and different bread companies, and various suppliers have been there have been disputes between designers and big companies saying basically you copied my design or whatever, but for you to sort it out, you'd have to employ a copyright lawyer, legal team.
I think so, and I'm only,
which is impossible.
I'm only a small business. Yeah, like I'm very lucky. It's grown to something that can sustain me, and it has now become my full time business. But I'm also not at the stage where I have a legal team. So, I just have to pursue it the way they have told me to pursue it, and then just hope. I think, to be honest, I think they'll just sell it for as long as they can until they get caught out. And now that they've been caught out, hopefully they will take it down. But it won't stop them doing it from stealing from other people, I don't
think. And do you think, I know you're talking about China, but do you think there's many, by the way, they're not selling your products exactly cheap either, are they?
No, it's more expensive than I sell it. I know, it's really cheeky, isn't it?
Cheeky, yeah. And it's, well, we know that if you go onto various Chinese websites, the stuff is It's just
very brazen.
Yeah.
And that's what's frustrating. It's people trying to make a quick buck out of other people who've really built their businesses and have built them slowly. So
Were they a good seller for you, Laura?
Yeah, it's a good seller. I sell it as a print and as a card. And the card especially would be quite a good seller. Yeah, it's become quite a good seller. And considering it's one of my simpler designs, it is a good seller.
And how do you think they came across it?
I honestly don't know. I think
have they whipped anything else off? That's what I'm thinking.
I don't think so. I did kind of go into their other products and I did a Google search of a few of my other design names and I couldn't find anything else. I haven't.
Yeah, but would they have said, well, we weren't able to contact the artist?
No, it would have been very obvious wherever the source was. Okay. It would have been obvious.
Then what's your own website called?
It's www.pickledpompom.com.
Okay. And how did you do, by the way, during lockdown? Did people start sending cards again?
Yeah,
hopefully?
It was great. It was great. I think people rediscovered the joy of sending someone a letter or a card with some nice words in it. And
what was a popular seller for a pom-pom?
I had a card that was my own kind of emotional rant one day. So I'm from Dublin, but I live in Kildare and all my family were in Dublin. So it was months when I wasn't seeing my friends or my family. So one evening I just went on a bit of an emotional rant and I wrote a quote about what I'd do when I saw people and I made it into a card. And that, like, to be honest, the business just was lockdown. I got through lockdown based on that card.
And what did that card say again?
So it said, wait till I see you. I'm going to get one now because I can't really go word for word. So it says, wait till I see you. I'm going to give you the biggest squeeze and we are going to eat takeaway and drink wine in the sunshine and say thanks be to holy Jesus that's over. And aren't we so lucky for all that we have. I can't wait. See you soon.
Okay. And then when you read out now the Chinese translation, please, Laura. saved them the bother of translating.
Yeah, I'm trying to translate.
Okay, well, listen, the name of your company again, Pom Pom.
It's Pickled Pom Pom.
Pickled Pom Pom.
It doesn't make any sense, but it's supposed to make people
and
intrigued.
What did you do in real life before you did cards?
I was a children's wear designer. A children's wear designer, so for retailers in Ireland.
Oh,
so,
well done. That sounds incredible.
And then I had three of my own children and it didn't really make sense to commute anymore. So I set up on my own and
Pickled Pom Pom
from there.
Pickled Pom Pom. But it is what it is. But it is unfair to say the least what they've done.
Yeah, it's frustrating. And when they didn't even do it right.
Okay. Thanks indeed, Laura Dempsey.
Thanks very much,
Pickled, Joe. PickledPomPom.com. PickledPomPom.com.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And Anne mentioned earlier on about Facebook and how brilliant it has been for Physical Impairment Ireland. But there is another side, as we've been hearing a lot of lately, especially from a whistleblower, about how she argued yesterday in the House of Commons at a select committee that Facebook, for example, she said, thrives on anger and greed and fear and that's what brings people online. But Sarah Murphy is a well-known Irish fashion designer. Sarah, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. Hi.
How are you? You're the subject of online abuse because you highlight on a regular basis sexual violence against women. Why do you write about it, Sarah?
Well, I suppose I write about it in relation to my own experiences. So when in my 20s, I developed anorexia after being raped. And I suppose I started talking about my own experiences online. And that's when the online hate began to pile in.
And it's hard for people, especially who aren't on any social media. But did the hatred start immediately? Did the abuse start immediately? I don't know how anyone could hate you if they haven't met you. So did the abuse start immediately, Sarah?
No, honestly, it didn't. At the beginning, it was very positive. And then gradually, I would start to get abusive messages sent to me, mostly directly sent to me. I would rarely get them in an open comment where, you know, everyone else can see it.
Okay.
It started with things I was able to brush off, like, you know, the usual, you're ugly, whatever, the kind of things. They're not nice to receive, but you're, you know, they're not crying at night over them. But I guess during lockdown, it really escalated, and I was getting almost daily at one point just messages that started to be more derogatory, really misogynistic, and kind of got more threatening in a way.
Mm-hmm. And is there any policing of it, Sarah? Is there anywhere, like, I was talking a few minutes ago to Laura Dempsey, and she got onto Walmart, one of the biggest companies in the world, and she got a response from them. But can you get onto any of these platforms and say, listen, can this be removed? Can that be removed?
So I've done a few things. So I have got on to, it's mostly on Instagram, I get them, which is owned by Facebook. So because they're direct messages, they can't really remove them because they've come in as a message. But I have had the accounts deleted that they've been sent from, which doesn't really make much difference because the messages are coming from anonymous accounts. So you can have a few, you can have your main account and you can have two or three other accounts attached to that. And so they're coming from those anonymous accounts that are, when you log on, there's not a person on there. They're not following anyone. No one follows them. It's just a spam account that they're using to send messages from. But I have had those removed. Instagram has removed some for me. They've also got features. So I have my own personal account as locked down as I possibly can at the moment. Mm-hmm. So people can't send comments to me. There is a new feature Instagram have that allow you to block certain phrases that people use or certain words so that they post in a comment, if they use that phrase or word, it doesn't become shown publicly. Mm-hmm. But that also, it doesn't help too much because they're coming through direct messages to me.
And what could, is the likes of Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp and the various other platforms, which people love in the main, but also are an awful force for evil, as you've discovered. Is there anything can be done?
I know I get, this is the question I get a lot of time, along with why haven't you left Instagram? I don't know. I know the new bill is about banning those anonymous accounts.
Okay.
Which, you know, it might help here in Ireland, but I wonder what the repercussions would be in other countries that maybe don't have our same, maybe human rights issues.
Good point, where governments
might just use them to spy on activists.
Or arrest out about them. Imprison people without trial.
Yeah.
China,
I mean,
for example,
that's the one thing I'm not worried about. I can speak out about issues in my own personal life online, and yes, you get hate mail, but I'm not worried that, you know, the secret police is going to turn up at my door. So that, I mean, I can see why that's initially where the legislation wants to go, because it is probably the easiest way to tackle online abuse here in Ireland. But I think Facebook have more to answer for, because people ask people like me, what's the answer? We ask government, what's the answer? But really, it's Facebook who needs to be coming up with the answer. They understand their algorithms much more than anyone else.
And with
else
a profit
do. I mean,
of, what was the
profit,
profits this year of something like 12 billion, churches, they should
be
well.
Yeah, their annual quarterly profits came out today and it was 7.8 million, billion euro. And that's just their quarterly profits. Yeah. So, you know, they have all the resources and they understand the platform better than anyone else will. I think the solutions need to come from them and also from people. It's people sending me these messages, you know?
Oh, I hear you. What would you call those people, Sarah? Mad, sad, or bad?
I really don't know. I don't understand why they're sending these messages. I mean, in a certain respect, I do. They're very misogynistic, and if you have those kind of views about women offline, it's very easy to have those kind of views online where there is no real-world repercussions for you for anything you say or do. It's not like, you know, if I was getting those comments in phone calls, I would feel more comfortable going to the police because they can trace that phone call and something might actually happen. But when it's an anonymous account sending things online, there's very little you can really do.
And did you find, Sarah, that when you've raised a number of issues, but one of the issues, and you explained why because of your own experience, the issue of sexual violence against women. Does that subject in particular attract more abuse from misogynists or mad, sad, yes, or bad people?
I mean, unequivocally, yes. I mean, if I was posting photos of my dog, I'm not getting those online hate messages. And as soon as I post something about sexual violence against women, against hate against women, that is, I will get messages in almost instantly.
Almost instantly. Good God.
Yeah.
And some of the messages you've got, I don't even think I should read them out. They're so horrific.
I'm not, I won't. Yeah, some of them, yeah. You probably can't read out at this time of day on the radio. yeah, but that's what I mean. They did kind of descend into being more threatening. The less I interact with the person, like I've never responded, and I think the more
you ignore,
the less I respond, the more it aggravates them. And they also know to delete the message, you have to see the message.
And do you think the Gardaí could make a difference or would make a difference?
It's not that if I'm very honest, it's not that they wouldn't try. I feel like there's very little they can do. I mean, I'm going to them and then they're going to Instagram, which is essentially Facebook, to get that person's details.
And then what happens?
And if they get them.
Yeah.
And if that's what I mean. If it was a phone call, I would feel like I had more recourse. They had more information to go on. But it's them going up against Facebook for, I'm not anyone important to get information about someone who's sending me hate online.
But you mentioned earlier that you developed an eating disorder after that awful, awful violent rape, which all rapes are. They're an act of violence, nothing else, an act of power and assault. But would you, how is your mental health now, Sarah? You're obviously strong enough that you feel by taking a public stance like this, that you're not as vulnerable maybe as you were after that horrific attack.
No, I certainly am, and I'm certainly a much stronger person. Not that I wasn't then, but I definitely fell apart for a while. Do you know what? I'm also quite stubborn. I suppose that's why I haven't left Instagram. It's one of my not so nice personality traits. I'm quite headstrong.
That's a strong personality.
But it definitely, it takes its toll on you. Do you know when you're sitting at home in your own house in the evening and you're online to friends and you can see those messages popping up, you feel like the person's almost come into your house. And the more threatening, and some of them are quite violent threats, Ireland's very small. You do worry, is someone going to turn up at my doorstep? Yeah. Is it someone that knows me? I think that would almost be worse. Do you know, is it someone that, you know, I've passed in the street or whatever?
Okay, it's a fascinating campaign, and don't give in, I think would be the message from people. Don't give in. And you're a fashion designer as well, as I know, like Laura told us, she was a children's. How's that end of your world going?
That's going actually very well since lockdown ended. Though I did spend a lot of the time during lockdown, I did some charity work for the Rape Crisis Centre, which was nice. I'd always wanted to do design stuff for them to raise funds, so at least lockdown gave me that opportunity. It's probably the reason I started to be online in the first place, and then this happened.
Okay, well, stay strong and stay safe, Sarah, and stay creative as well, which you are. That's Sarah Murphy. Thanks indeed. That's Irish fashion designer Sarah Murphy. Joe at RTE.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And the passing of Grainne Kenny, who's been on this programme many, many times, a great anti-drugs campaigner, cannot go unremarked on national radio. She died in the past week. Grainne, as you know, has been, for many decades, she's been very vigilant on the whole issue of drugs. And she's not employed by any organisation. It was her own energy, her own effort, her own research in a lot of cases, because she was just brilliant in terms of facts and figures. I remember how strong she was on the campaign, almost led the campaign with lots of families, especially mothers around the country, when we discovered that there was 100 head shops open in Dublin just over 10 years. Open in the country. 100 head shops selling those awful, awful, dangerous drugs. And within, Grania was in the campaign, people from Boyle, people from Athlone, people from Dublin all joined in the campaign. But Grania was among the most vociferous. And in one fell swoop, Dermot O'Hearn and Mary Harney, between the Minister for Health and Minister for Justice, in one day, shut down every single head shop in Ireland, which is a remarkable work by any legislator. And that awfulness disappeared, thankfully, off our streets. And she was also a great campaigner and supporter of Father Shea Cullen in the States. Child abusers been travelling from Ireland to the Philippines. So to Grania and to Grania's family, may we express our condolences. The death of a great, great and inspirational campaigner, Grania Kenny. Now, Brian, good afternoon. We were talking last week about hobbyists and collectors. You collected what could only be regarded as a very, very unique motorbike, a classic Honda 90.
Good afternoon, Joe. Yes, I did indeed. It's one of a number of bikes, I suppose, that I describe it as an illness, collecting motorcycles, but it's an illness that sustained me through the years, and I take great pride in it, yes.
And what's the difference between a Honda 50 and a Honda 90?
Well, Joe, Honda 90...
Don't say 40.
It's about 10 mile an hour, I suppose,
is
Joe,
yeah, okay,
is the best way of putting it. Yeah, yeah. But I suppose more specifically, this bike was it was a special import from Japan. It's used exclusively by the Japanese Postal Service over there. So it's not freely available to the general public. But it's a sort of an upgraded Honda 90. It's kind of heavy duty to deal with those loads, etc. So with my advancing years and advancing weight that goes with it, I thought it was the best option for me.
So you specifically imported it, but the bike is gone.
No, the bike has been recovered.
Yeah, but it's in a terrible state, is it not?
It's in a pretty bad state at the moment. So it was stolen, I suppose, from my son. Was about to use it in UCC. He's studying down there in Cork, and we brought it down there for him for transport. And he was about to sit his bike test, but within a week it was stolen from the underground car park there on Sunday evening at about 7:15. And ironically enough, David was doing his studies, looked out the window as he heard a noise and saw two young lads making away on his dad's pride and joy. So,
And you've sent us a photograph of it, as you had it. It's beautifully, beautifully presented with the original pillion. I presume these are pillion boxes that the Japanese Postal Service, the frame at the front for holding another bag, I presume. And it's very, very well kept. Okay, you reckon these two young offenders were just acting the agent? They weren't coming specifically looking for a very rare Honda 90.
I don't know if they're looking for, I don't know their motivation for picking that bike in particular, Joe, but it wasn't opportunistic. They came armed because they were able to cut the lock and hotwire the ignition and break the steering lock. So within a few minutes, they had the bike away, even though it was well secured and, you know, in a lit underground CCTV monitored area. So it didn't deter them, you know.
So you searched frantically, but you found it burnt out in waste grounds.
I did. Got a lot of help from an appeal out on Facebook for information, as well as obviously David reported the Gardaí immediately. And the good people of Cork rallied, I say, tremendously in terms of sightings of the bike where it's been ridden around and whatever. And we were lucky enough then, with the help of, I have some family down there, so a couple of cousins and myself, and my son went searching fields where it was reported in, and we found it partly burnt out in some undergrowth there.
And is there anything missing from it?
Yeah, the panniers that you mentioned, they're actually ex-army ammunition boxes that I made myself and fitted to the bike. They're missing. They're gone. The main box is gone from it. Some mirrors and the tax is gone from it. The registration number and the rest, you know, cease, and a lot of the plastics are burnt out on it, you know.
And can you restore it?
I can, Joe. Yes, I can and I will.
Good man.
There's an excellent company in Dublin that imports these little bikes, the quirky and unusual stuff from Japan, Retro Bikes Dublin, and they will be able to source the parts for me.
But you say there's a journal, the logbook. What happened that?
I'm a little bit anal, as those that know me would describe me as, in relation to my bikes, Joe. So when I got the bike, I kept a little journal, a little notebook, as I do with all my bikes.
Of course,
Every time I'd go out on a spin, I'd record the mileage, and I'd record, you know, any issues with the bike or any maintenance or upkeep or whatever, along with the date. So that was in the box, unfortunately, and that's gone missing as well, you know. So that's an additional loss, you know.
Okay. Well, hopefully, if anyone has if anyone comes across a logbook that looks different and is your name on it, Brian?
No, it's not. It's just a small notebook with the details of the bike on the cover, and that's all it is, Joe. It isn't anything official, notebook.
Okay, we'll ask people about Jeffrey. Okay, Brian Leonard, keep up the enthusiasm, Brian. It's a great,
Joe.
Well done. Brian Leonard, Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815. Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Well, I'm off to talk to Dahi Mara and Emer in the Cork studio about why I think As the Smoke Clears by Zoe Holohan deserves your vote in the Unpost Irish Book Awards Audience Choice. As the Smoke Clears, a truly remarkable story. Annette Egan produced. Brenda Dunn, who's next?
Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Coming soon, the all-new Sportage. For more, log on to kia.com.
1850-715-815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe at rte.ie.
Thank you very much, Joe. And it's 3 o'clock news now with Shane McGowan.
Thanks, Brenda. Good afternoon. A search in County Kildare by Gardaí investigating the disappearance of Deirdre Jacob and other women over 20 years has ended. In a statement, Gardaí said that nothing of evidential value to the investigations was recovered during the search. It began after it emerged that unusual activity was noticed at the